Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions. Okay, today the show will pick up where we left off a couple of weeks ago, where we were talking about corporate strategy in the current period. And that earlier show of 2 weeks ago, we talked about how corporate strategy shifted and changed in the 1970s. And took on a more aggressive mode and directly began to attack unions and deunionize the workforce in this country, which has had disastrous effects on wages and income and contributed significantly to income inequality trends that everyone's talking about nowadays. Sort of gave an overview of how that strategy, that new corporate strategy, rolled out beginning in the 70s and 80s and continuing ever since, including today, with its objective of destroying unions in the U.S. Okay, so let's recap that a little bit, because the show today will focus on a second element of that corporate strategy, closely associated to the deunionization strategy, which is the destruction of collective bargaining, and particularly the destruction of collective bargaining so that wages and benefits could be frozen and or rolled back. And that, of course, has happened in the last 30 years, concomitant with the destruction of unions. Okay. So to recap a little bit, and the show today will be part two of corporate strategy, and that part two is the destruction of collective bargaining, or the transformation of collective bargaining, you might say. Collective bargaining transformed from a tool institution that unions use to achieve wage and benefit increases for its members to a tool that increasingly is used to the advantage of management to roll back those wage and benefits of the prior period. Okay, so the transformation, the inversion of collective bargaining, you might say. Okay, so to recap a little bit, because this deunionization, this corporate attack on unions to destroy unions is, you know, one side of this coin. The other side of the coin, well, why are you destroying unions? Well, because you want to roll back wages and benefits, and collective bargaining is the tool for achieving wage and benefits. Therefore, you got to get control of collective bargaining to roll back those wages and benefits. So unions and collective bargaining are two sides of the same coin. They're the same thing. And to destroy one means you're going to use it to destroy the other. And that's the connection here that we want to talk about. Okay, so in 1970s, we had 2 weeks ago described how corporate America reorganized itself. And out of that reorganization came a new set of strategies, a new set of anti-worker strategies. Sometimes that's called neoliberalism, at least insofar as it addresses unions and wages. There is an international global element to neoliberalism, where U.S. capitalists restructured, reorganized as well to take on their foreign capitalist competitors, and to also take on that part of the global economy that was not firmly in control of the capitalist market. In other words, what was left of the Soviet Union and other states. There was three elements to neoliberalism. And we're talking about the one, which is the focus on domestic policies and domestic control of labor. By the way, as I said last week, I don't like the idea, concept of neoliberalism. It's very confusing to most folks. It implies that these are liberal policies, liberal meaning quote, quasi-progressive in the minds of most folks, but they're nowhere near liberal. They're really aggressive anti-worker, anti-working class consumer policies domestically. Okay, so we should abandon this term neoliberalism, which is a creation of academics, and simply call it what it is, corporate strategy, capitalist strategy, aimed at workers and competitors and states, governments that aren't within the capitalist market realm, weren't at least at that time back in the 70s. Okay, so this reorganization occurs in the 1970s, and you know, for further description of that, I would refer listeners to my article that's just come out in Z Magazine for October, which is called Corporate Anti-Union Strategy, and that can be found as well on my website, which is kyklosproductions.com, kyklosproductions.com. You can get to that from my blog, jackrasmus.com. You can read the article there, or you can get it from Z Magazine. But this is the first part of a three-part article on corporate strategy. The second part is what we're talking about today, the destruction of collective bargaining. And the third will be the destruction of union political power and influence. Okay. So, keep in mind that this restructuring by capitalists, by corporations, is not new. You know, the latest one, as I have been arguing, occurs in the 70s and 80s, and it's still ongoing. You know, it's a dynamic thing. They add elements to it, and, you know, they de-emphasize other elements, like, you know, free trade becomes increasingly important. In the 1990s, it was not part of the original strategy there in the 1970s and 80s. And, you know, other elements and emphasis, you know, the privatization of healthcare, for example, becomes an element in the 1990s under Clinton and then in Bush. And the latest reflection of that is Obama's ACA, privatize healthcare. Okay, so corporate restructurings, capitalist restructurings, have a long history, and they usually follow or precede wars. If you look at the Civil War, there was a major restructuring of capitalism, corporates, the rise of corporations per se, in that period immediately following the 1860s, 1880s. Then there was another major restructuring on the eve of World War One, just before World War One and during World War One. Then another third major restructuring of capitalist American capitalism in the immediate post World War Two period, from about 1944 on. You know, we get Bretton Woods, and we get the dollar, we get all these changes, and that has a domestic. That has a domestic element to it as well. And that domestic element, of course, is the Taft-Hartley Act, which occurs at that time, in 1947. And then finally we get the fourth restructuring of capital in the 1970s and 80s. We're talking about American capitalism here, American corporations. So we can point to historically over the last century or so at least four major restructurings. By capitalism, by corporate America itself. And we've been arguing that labor in the past responded with a reorganization of its own to address this new corporate offensive, which has this organizational element to it. We see after 1860s the rise of a new form of union worker organization called the Knights of Labor. And then in the 1890s and about that time, we find the rise of the craft unions, American Federation of Labor, replacing the Knights of Labor. And that was a more effective response to the corporate offensive at the time. But the craft union idea was not as effective against the big, massive industrialized companies in the early 20th century. So we have the rise of the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations, the rise of industrial form of unionism, and just before World War One, and then, of course, in the 20s and 30s. But we haven't had, this is an important point, we haven't had a restructuring, a reorganizing of union labor and the working class in this country following the most recent corporate capitalist restructuring and reorganization in the 70s and 80s. This is the period we're in now, where business, corporations, capitalists, or whatever you want to call them, effectively reorganized themselves in the 70s and 80s, came up with a new set of strategies that academics call neoliberalism. But labor did not respond. Labor did not similarly reorganize itself to confront the new offensive. And as a result, the corporate offensive since the 70s and 80s has been increasingly successful in its attack on labor, and union labor in particular. And we have this labor retreat, union worker retreat, for more than three decades now on all fronts. We've seen, as we talked about last week and in my article, the collapse of union membership. That's a direct result of corporate strategy that's been successful, but labor strategy response that did not happen. Also, as we're going to talk about here today, the destruction, inversion, transformation of collective bargaining. And as we will talk about in a future show, the impact on union, labor, worker political influence in the system declined precipitously in the last three decades. All of this can be explained by these corporate offensives and the lack of a corresponding strategic response by labor and workers. Okay. So keep those points in mind of the corporate reorganizing and restructuring historically and most recently, and the lack most recently of a labor response to that. And the consequence of all that is that corporate strategies, which are related to the restructuring, have been successful. And union counter-strategies, defensive strategies, have not been successful because there's been no reorganization and there's been no real strategic change on the part of labor on how it confronts and deals with this problem. Okay. After 1972, as we described a couple weeks ago, we have the beginning of deunionization setting in this country. And I described that time how this began with the construction unions, attack on construction unions as part of this corporate reorganization and new strategy, using management using what was called double-breasted operations, setting up shadow corresponding non-union companies and then moving to work from the union to the non-union. Preventing unions from protesting this by picketing the non-union sites and disallowing labor law reform that would allow the unions to organize these new non-union sites. Of course, the lack of picketing rights and labor law reform were two legislative defeats for labor in the late 70s, which was the primary objectives of the construction unions to deal with the attack on them, but they did not succeed. The legislation in a Congress of where the House and Senate were both majority Democrats, and the president was Democrat, Jimmy Carter, still did not succeed. So we're beginning to see the tie-in with the political strategy relying on the Democratic Party. Really not helping labor in terms of its organizing membership strategy. Okay, and then we talked about how management, corporate America, moved to take on the manufacturing unions in the late 70s, early 80s, after they had effectively broken the membership back of the construction unions, tamed them, I should say. And the strategy was a little different, in some ways similar, in taking on the manufacturing unions. The good example was the Chrysler bailout in the late 1970s, 1979. Most of corporate America purposely slowed down its investment in new plant and equipment in the U.S. during the 1970s, used that as an excuse to get tax cuts from the government to reinvest again. And when they did that, they invested in runaway shops. In other words, they did not reinvest in Detroit and in the North, steel mills and Pennsylvania and so forth, where the unions were. They went south, and they invested their new plants in the southern states and the Southwest. And then, of course, they would move to Mexico, and then they would move even further out as free trade agreements were added to these tax changes for corporations that allowed them to invest. And the government and American taxpayer pay the ticket for that investment that would eliminate jobs. So, in a sense, the strategy for manufacturing was set up double-breasted operations, but not in the regions and in the U.S. itself. Set them up elsewhere, and we had this phenomenon of corporate tax cuts to allow corporations to invest abroad, for example, and then as they went abroad, not just to the southern states in the U.S., but went abroad offshore to other countries, then we introduced free trade, which allows these companies that have offshore gone abroad, producing the goods with foreign labor offshore, to then re-import that labor back to the U.S. without having to pay tariffs and taxes. So you've got to see that free trade is part and parcel of the corporate tax policies of recent decades of neoliberalism, and they go hand in hand, and together they destroyed manufacturing jobs in the U.S., and in particular unions that were highly organized in manufacturing. The third target was the Teamsters Union, and that's where industry corporate deregulation comes in. A little bit different, because it doesn't make sense to offshore transport in the U.S., trucking and so forth, right? Railroads, you can't offshore that. You got to move the stuff, within the U.S. anyway. So a different strategy was needed there. And that strategy was deregulation. In other words, deregulate the trucking industry, give preference to preference to the rise of all these other corporations, new trucking companies. Competition will result in layoffs, and the unionized trucking companies would have to lay off and reduce wages to compete. So this, too, was a kind of a double-breasted operation, but double-breasted by deregulation, you see. At the same time, as we pointed out, the rise of the union-busting law firms prevented new unionization, made it very hard for unions to organize, made it easy for companies to terrorize workers that wanted unions by firing them and threatening them and getting away with it. And when unions actually even won elections to represent workers, then the law firms and the legal changes would allow them to put it off for months and years even, and then everyone gets discouraged and they go somewhere else. So the law, union-busting law firms, and the changes in the procedures in the National Labor Relations Board play a big role here. At the same time, in the services industry, what you got was rules and regulation changes that allowed the rise of what's called contingent labor, part-time and temp workers, contract workers, who by definition were kept outside the union bargaining units. This was part of the NLRB offensive, government assisting the corporate offensive as well. union law, busting law firms and the creating of part-time temp jobs outside the bargaining unit, or exempting the skilled workers who are critical for strike effectiveness in companies, exempting them, putting them outside the bargaining unit as well. And then we have the open shop movement, where open shop means that folks can't join, don't have to join unions, can be prevented from joining unions. That spread from state to state. That's a statewide thing. That was part of the offensive, both with public employees more recently, and also in the sense of private sector unions as well. Okay, so all of these methods and means that we talked about last time resulted in a massive decline in union membership from the late 70s on. 1980, we had 20 million, roughly 20 million workers who were unionized out of a total labor force of 90 million. So we had about 22% unionized. And, of course, in the main industries like manufacturing, construction, and Teamsters before that, it was, 50 to 60, 70% unionized. So most of those industries were unionized, and the average was 22% in 1980. Well, by 2013, all of these policies, deunionization, result in only 14 million who are unionized out of 155 million workforce. So we grow the workforce by two-thirds, and that was 60 million people are added to the workforce. We still lose 5 million people. And the percentage average of the workforce unionized today is only 11%. So we go from 22% to 11%. Now, with unionization's cut in half, we lose 5 million absolute members and 15 million potential members. If we had 22% unionized today, there'd be 35 million people in unions instead of 14.5 million. Well, you can imagine what the bargaining power and the ability of unions to play a role politically would be today if they had 20 million more members, if they just held the line where they were in 1980. So this corporate offensive has been very successful in destroying union membership ranks. And if you destroy union membership ranks, you destroy collective bargaining. Collective bargaining, as I said before, is this tool that cannot be separated from union membership. Right? It's the other side of the coin of union membership. And the topic for the rest of the show today is how collective bargaining was transformed from an institution and means for workers and their unions to advance their standard of living by negotiating increases in wages and benefits, better job security, and rights on the job, working conditions, how it's been transformed from that to its opposite increasingly. In other words, as a tool for management to take away those same wages and benefits and rights. It's been inverted. It's being turned on its head. Now, it's not totally destroyed yet, just as the unions are not totally destroyed yet, but it's been significantly affected, significantly impacted from a tool for workers' gains to a tool to take away those gains. And what we've been seeing with collective bargaining is, in this period since the 1980s, a transformation of it at several other levels. We talked about 2 weeks ago how we have this great strike wave in 1970, 71, great strike wave, perhaps the biggest strike wave, most successful in this country, where unions that were strong, particularly the construction unions, the manufacturing unions, and the Teamsters, the trucking unions, were able to build up what was called national contracts and introduce what's called pattern bargaining. National contracts mean a nationwide trucking agreement. All trucking you know, interstate trucking have to adhere to this nationwide terms and conditions for wages and benefits. And we had a national agreement in autos and in steel and in other basic manufacturing. In other words, all of the steel companies in the country had to more or less sign on to this agreement. It was a period of significant union bargaining power. If you have national agreements, you have more bargaining power. Take on one of the companies and make the others go along with it. Well, that's also called pattern bargaining. You see, national bargaining, pattern bargaining go hand in hand. Pattern bargaining means the company, have to follow the pattern in your industry that's been established, with the union and one of the other large companies. And you can have pattern bargaining within your industry, like was the case in autos, you know, GM agreement, and Ford and Chrysler had to go along with it. And you can also have it across industries. And that's what happened in early 1970s. The construction unions got big wage and benefit increases, and the Teamsters who deliver to construction sites say, hey, we deserve the same. They negotiated big agreements. Teamsters also deliver goods to auto companies and so forth, and it spilled over. And workers and unions were extremely successful and were able to achieve in collective bargaining in the early 70s, wage and benefit increases of 20% in the first year of a typical three-year contract. 20%, folks. All of you out there who think you're doing great if you get 2, you know, just think of those that came before. You were getting 20%. And the corporations, the companies, could not stop it. They could not stop it on their own. We weren't in a world of globalization yet where they could really threaten to move offshore. This was before all of this offshoring started, right? So they had to bring in the state. They had to bring in the government to stop labor and unions. And that's what Richard Nixon did with his wage freeze and wage controls. And then they engineered significant inflation that took away some of those wages and benefit wages, at least reduced the real wages. And then they introduced the worst recession, 73-75, that tamed labor even further. And then we get a Democrat in Congress, Jimmy Carter, who pretty much doesn't do anything on behalf of unions and laborers, doesn't really support labor bills, and sides with the employers when it comes to picketing, construction picketing limitations and NLRB limitations on organizing, sides with them. Labor law reform doesn't really support it aggressively. In the late 70s, and then sides with management when it comes to deregulating the trucking industry, which began on his watch, and sides with management in creating this corporate bailout of Chrysler that becomes the template for attacking manufacturing unions. So this attack on unions and collective bargaining really begins before Ronald Reagan. You know, people think that, oh, Ronald Reagan comes in office and he fires all the air traffic controllers, PATCO, and therefore the attack on union begins. No, it begins well into the 1970s by the companies themselves, and Jimmy Carter, the Democrats, line up behind it even before Ronald Reagan is elected. Of course, when he gets elected, it accelerates. The attack accelerates and intensifies and has continued ever since, but it begins before Reagan. And the policies that Reagan introduces are the policies that corporate America, in its reorganization in late 70s, decided to push. So Reagan just implements what they've already asked him to do. See, it's not his ideas. He's just a good speaker. You know, he's a mouthpiece and a very good one. Right? But these ideas are really the ideas of corporate America when it comes to tax cuts and free trade and offshoring and creating temp workers and part-time workers and dismantling pensions by introducing 401k plans and all these other measures that are the hallmark of Reaganomics or Reagan policy, sometimes called neoliberalism, you know. This takes form before he comes into office by these new corporate think tanks and new forms of corporate organization like the Business Roundtable and Business Council and so forth. He's an implementer of this. This comes from the capitalist class themselves, right? So let's look at what happens to collective bargaining since the late 1970s. Right? Well, the consequences, as we're going to see, is the decline of real wages. You know, since 1982, if you look at median wages for production and non-supervisory production workers, i.e. the working class, about 110 million folks in that category, 115 maybe. These are not managers. These are not self-employed. These are not CEOs and professionals and so forth. This is not the capitalist class. This is the core of the working class, 110 million households, roughly. Ever since then, the wages have atrophied or declined, depending, you know, where you are. If you're in low wage, mid wage, high wage, you know, they've stagnated. These wages have stagnated and adjusted for inflation. They've gone nowhere. At the same time, capital incomes, you know, capital gains, dividends, stock appreciation, you know, executive compensation, all this has just accelerated, gone through the roof. So workers have stayed at best stagnant or gone down, you know, in terms of wages. And at the same time, you have capital income folks. Well, no wonder. No wonder we have this growing income inequality. It's been going on for three decades, you know, and the academics have just discovered it. And they still can't explain it. We'll talk about that. They can't explain it because they don't bother to look at it from a class perspective, that it has a lot to do with the attack on wages and workers, therefore the attack on collective bargaining, and therefore the attack on unions themselves. Okay, the biggest contributor to this wage compression, as it's called, is the lack of creation of good-paying jobs. Lack of job creation, period. And to the extent that we have job creation, these are low-paid jobs. You know, part-time temp jobs, no benefit jobs, et cetera. You know, 1-2% at best increases per year. But they don't look at it from the job perspective. Well, we'll talk about that some more, and I've written about that quite a bit. You know, this famous book just came out by Thomas Piketty, called Capital. Really, it's not about capital. It's about income inequality and focusing on the tax system as the central cause, or executive compensation as the primary cause of inequality. Well, those things have contributed to it, but they're not the cause. The cause of inequality has its roots in this attack on workers in this country and the failure to create decent jobs at decent pay while they're rolling back unions and rolling back all these other forms of wages and benefits. That's how corporations have increased profits to record levels through recession and non-recession alike. And, of course, then the tax system allows them to pass through those super profits obtained at workers' expense to their shareholders in the form of increased dividends or stock buybacks, et cetera. You know, that's how it's done. So the tax system is a conduit. It's an enabler for the income inequality. But it's not a fundamental cause of it. The fundamental cause of it lies in these policies that have frozen and rolled back workers' wages in this country. Okay. All right. Collective bargaining and unionization are integrally one and the same. You know, workers fought for centuries here to unionize for the purpose of bargaining to improve their wages and working conditions and standard of living. That's what unionization was all about. It wasn't simply to say, oh, we got a union. It was to enable them to sit down and get a better piece of the pie by negotiating collectively with management. So the two have always been closely related, unions and union growth and strength and collective bargaining effectiveness. And, of course, as the former has declined, we see the transformation of collective bargaining as a tool to help management roll back, take back what they agreed to in previous periods. Unions in the 19th century were considered illegal and therefore could not negotiate. I mean, the whole idea of declaring them illegal combinations, as they said at the time, was to prevent them from getting together and negotiating. Negotiating collectively was considered restraint of trade. In other words, it was kind of like a monopoly in negotiating wages. And the courts used that as an excuse because there were laws about antitrust and collusion by companies to raise prices. Well, they considered workers getting together was a form of collusion to raise wages, which is a price of labor. And the courts were the first defense at this time against union labor. They were illegal. Unions were illegal. Collective bargaining was illegal. Well, if the workers were strong enough, they did it anyway. If they were able to form some sort of organization like the Knights of Labor after the Civil War, you know, there was some attempt to do that anyway. But in the 19th century, you know, we have these big depressions in the 1870s and 1890s, and then a rolling recession after 1907. And each time we had a big depression, labor was wiped out, pretty much. And then it came back and had a new form of organization each time. You know, Knights of Labor were wiped out by the Great Depression of the 1870s, and then the rise of the AFL, American Federation of Labor, craft unions, skilled workers unions, you know, in the 1890s in the wake of that depression. And then the attempts to form industrial unions with the IWW and the Railway Union, National Railway Union, then, of course, the success of the CIO in that regard in the 1930s. But there was no legal support until the 1920s and 30s for the right to have a union and bargain. It was always the two were closely related. Unions, by the way, and bargaining were kind of tolerated during war periods because the state and corporations needed their support for war production. But typically after the wars, the tacks were relaunched and the unions were driven down again. That was very clearly after World War I, clearly the case, right? And even an attack after World War II. Okay, so only a few of the unions hang on until we get into the 1930s, then we get the National Labor Relations Act, called the Wagner Act at the time, which said two things. One, workers have the right to unionize, and they have the right to collective bargaining. You know, the two elements went hand in hand, showing the close relationship between unionization and collective bargaining. Once again, they're two sides of the same coin. You unionize in order to bargain. Right? You can't bargain very effectively by yourself. So you've got to bargain collectively, so collectively you unionize. Right? So we finally get laws, but quickly in World War II, the laws that were established in 1935, well, even before that, were, you know, the attempt was to begin limiting the Wagner Act and the right to unionize and bargain. Again, during World War II, government and corporations needed unions and workers and tolerate them, so, you know, they let them organize without opposition. But they couldn't negotiate wages, and they couldn't negotiate or couldn't strike. You know, it gave up your right to strike and your wage increases, but you could work lots of hours, all you wanted, so you could make up wages and income growth by working longer hours. Now, World War II also introduced for the first time benefits bargaining. This was a big change. Instead of just bargaining for wages, you know, unionizing to get the company to recognize the union as the bargaining agent. That was the first thing. That's what the Wagner Act allowed, fundamentally. And if you are in war and you can't negotiate wages and you can't strike, well, then you negotiate benefits. And the mine workers was the union that first pioneered this. You know, prior to the 1940s, you know, a pension for workers was unheard of. No one had pensions except maybe some managers, top managers. You know, retirement, well, that's tough, you know. Maybe your family took care of you. That was it, right? And, of course, no one had any kind of health care at that time. So both retirement and health care, you know, were, no one had that if you were a worker. Unions were primarily about getting wage increases and protecting workers' rights on the job from arbitrary management decisions and so forth, and negotiating some kind of system where layoffs would be done in an orderly, non-discriminatory manner, and promotions would be based on merit and some sort of objective basis. And that's where seniority came in, seniority bargaining. That's all about some sort of objective workers' rights so that you don't have arbitrary decisions being made by management. But, you know, when unions finally got the right to organize and negotiate and in the 30s, it was mostly about wages, you know, just starting out the most important thing. But by World War II, negotiations began to occur because you couldn't negotiate wage increases on the, you know, on the subjects of pensions and health and welfare, as they call it, employer-negotiated health care. The mine workers union pioneered this. And in the post-war period, after World War II, this whole idea of pension bargaining and health care, employer-provided health care, really took off. At first, corporations strongly resisted it. But then the government, the state, stepped in and said, hey, look, you know, we got this opportunity in post-World War II where everyone, you know, U.S. is the only country that wasn't destroyed, and there's super, super profits to be made worldwide. You know, let's not fight over it here. Let's have an agreement, a social compact, and you capitalists, you know, we want you to negotiate benefits, pensions, and so forth, and health care. We want you to go that route because what we're going to do, we, the government's going to do, we're going to let you deduct all the costs from your taxes that you put into pensions and health care. Yes, a big tax deduction. In other words, the taxpayer would pay for what corporations give workers in benefits, in pensions, and so forth. And we're going to sweeten the pot here for you guys, you corporations, because not only deducted from your taxes, but you can count the pension funds and the welfare health funds that grow as a result of contributions. You can count that as profits on your balance sheet. Whoa, looks like you're making more profits than you are. You CEOs get more bonuses. The stock prices go up. Stockholders like this. Right? So there were real benefits for negotiating, two companies for negotiating benefits, you might say. There was a liability here, too, and that was these pension plans were called the defined benefit plans. In other words, companies had to pay pensions to folks. It had, you know, regardless of how the company was doing, it had a liability to pay pensions, typically like $50 per every year of service. After 30 years, you get a defined benefit pension, guaranteed liability, and nothing to do with what happens in the stock market. But that didn't impact them yet because we had a very young workforce after World War II, and you know, people weren't retiring yet. They start retiring, you know, in the 80s and after. And one thing that really happens in the 1980s is a transformation of pension bargaining begins to occur. With the help of the government, under Reagan, they introduced 401k plans as an alternative to pensions. 401k plans began to grow, and defined benefit pensions began to decline in number. There were once 150,000 defined benefit pension plans in this country in 1980s. It's about 20,000 now. So companies, over the last 30 years have been getting rid of their defined benefit pensions now that people are retiring, right? And substituting 401k plans for those. All right. One of the other advantages of negotiating benefits in the late 40s, early 50s was it took the heat off politicians to expand Social Security for everybody and include in Social Security this universal health care. You know, everyone thought in the 30s and during World War II that that's what was going to come next. Once Social Security retirement benefits got established, what we're going to do is expand them and include universal health care for everybody, just like, you know, other countries were doing after World War II. But, you know, if you did that, you would have to increase the employer contribution to payroll taxes, and that wasn't tax deductible. What was tax deductible was for the companies to put money into the pension and health care funds. Right? So companies preferred to do that rather than increase Social Security. And a big strategic error was made by unions because they more or less abandoned expanding Social Security and went off and negotiated pension and health care for just their members. You know, retrospectively looking back, that was a big strategic error. Because today what you got is the wholesale unwinding and destruction of pension plans. And now with the ACA, Obama's ACA, the destruction of the right to negotiate union employer-provided health care plans. This is ending in 2018. So all these years where the unions have been pumping, agreeing to pump money into pensions and health care plans, they're being destroyed now in the latest change of collective bargaining. And all of that effort, all those deferred wages, are going to be for naught. One of the big strategic errors, you know, not pushing for Social Security, universal health care. Oh, they said that they would support it, but that's just mouthing, not real support for decades now. And now what was called maintenance of benefits bargaining since the 1990s, the strategy for bargaining for unions, is a dead end. It's a dead end. And all those wages deferred are going to be lost, are being lost. Okay, so that's a big transformation. We have the elimination of pattern bargaining, elimination of national contracts, and then the shift to maintenance of benefits bargaining. We have the rise of benefits bargaining in the early 40s, 50s, 60s. And now we have in the 80s, 90s maintenance of benefits where we're trying to hold on to those benefits by agreeing to give up wage increases, you see. So the benefits bargaining is used as a tool to drive down wages. And then the benefits themselves are eliminated. After management uses benefits bargaining as a tool to repress wages, it turns around and then eliminates the benefits. Very effective, very clever here. And the unions are caught holding the bag. So national bargaining, pattern bargaining, maintenance of benefit bargaining, these are the different phases, and each one is destroyed, and each one is undermined as management takes greater and greater control of the bargaining process itself. And we talk about the post-1980 period as concession bargaining. First on wages, you know, under Reagan and so forth, rolling back, freezing wages, and then now concessions on the realm of benefits as well. And what was in the 80s and 90s a reduction in the level of wages and benefits, we might call that the magnitude of wages and benefits, is now, in after 2000, a focus on eliminating whole categories of areas that were once negotiated. And that was the scope of bargaining is being restricted and rolled back as well. You can see that in the public sector, where they don't want unions in certain states, Republican states, they've taken off, taken away from unions the ability to negotiate pensions and health benefits. Now they can no longer negotiate that. Or in the auto industry, the auto companies convinced the auto workers union, well, let's stop negotiating for health insurance. Right? We'll just turn it over to you, turn the fund over to you. It's called a VEBA, you know. VEBA, VEBA plan, where the unions get dumped what's left of employer contributions, and GM and others no longer negotiate health benefits. Right? And then under Obama in 2018, a 40% tax is going to be levied on union health care plans. So that's the end of negotiating health care coverage, health insurance by unions. Right, so the attack is on eliminating these whole categories. Other strategic shifts in bargaining in recent decades have been, instead of negotiating increases in a wage schedule that companies might have, they don't raise the wage schedules. They just give everybody a lump sum. Okay, we'll give you, you know, $500 for the year and that kind of a thing, which saves them a lot of money, because when you increase the schedule, you know, on top of increasing the schedule, it ends up far more than a lump sum. The whole drift towards two-tier wage schedules. In other words, new employees come in, they have a schedule that, you know, schedule meeting for every 6 months or a year you get a raise, so forth, that is lower in at every step than workers who are already there. That's called two-tier wage schedules. Or you have a longer schedule for new workers. It takes them 48 months to get to the top instead of 24 months for existing workers. So two-tier wage bargaining. Started in the 80s and 90s, and now, of course, it's two-tier benefits bargaining, expanding it to benefits. There used to be cost of living adjustments, COLA clauses. They've been eliminated altogether. There used to be supplemental unemployment benefits. In other words, the company would have to put money into a fund if you were unemployed. On top of what the government paid you unemployment benefits, you would get more from the company. And at one point, like in the auto industry, you got laid off and you got 95% of your income. Right? All kind of on-call pay and portal pay, you know, like mine workers used to get paid from the time they walked onto the company property and time it took them to get down to the, you know, into the mine, they would get paid for that. Well, they don't get paid for that in many cases. Overtime pay. Well, millions of people in the last, workers in the last decade have been simply converted from hourly wage to salary, which means you don't get any overtime pay. Saves the company saves businesses tens of billions of dollars a year. The whole paid time off has been reduced. You know, Americans get the least amount of paid vacation of anybody in the industrial world, less than 2 weeks on average. You know, you go to Europe and places like that, you get a guaranteed 4 weeks, 4 weeks to begin with, minimum, paid. How about paid leave? You know, if you get... you know, if you have a child and so forth, yeah, we get some leave now for a couple months, but it's not paid, right? You go to Germany, you get 2 years full pay if you have a kid. 2 years off full pay. Okay, so, you know, these comparisons are really significant. And it's not just a reversal concession bargaining here, maintenance of benefit bargaining that's now collapsing, and concession bargaining, two tiers, lump sum, COLA, subs, all this stuff eliminated. since the 1980s, management's rights have increased significantly. Management can fire you for all kinds of things that you do off the job that they never could do before. Workers' rights on the job are significantly limited. How about seniority? Well, seniority has been gutted. The latest thing, we see the attack on teachers, and, well, there they call seniority tenure. That's going on. The right to hire all kinds of temp workers. Unions prevented that in the past. You can hire somebody full-time or don't hire them. Part-time, involuntary part-time, reduction of hours of work. And, of course, all kinds of things about limiting strikes and job actions and so forth. These are all things that have been occurring in the last 30 years that reduce both the magnitude of wage and benefits that were negotiated previously, but are now wiping out whole categories of what workers can negotiate. Topics of negotiation, like, employer health benefits disappearing as a bargaining topic, and certainly will disappear in most cases by 2018. And then, of course, pension bargaining, right? You don't bargain over 401ks, you bargain over defined benefit plans, but if they're being eliminated right and left and converted where they do exist to 401ks, then you have a destruction of pensions. Most of the defined benefit pensions have been destroyed, particularly for new employees. Usually what management does is phase them out. The old employees can keep it until they retire, and then the new ones don't have it. All they got is 401ks. And companies, even on 401ks, don't make the same kind of contributions. They used to make it as you contributed into your 401k per each paycheck. They would contribute, maybe 50 cents per dollar or something if it was a good 401k. But now, like IBM, they do it only once at the end of the year, right before Christmas, after they do layoffs. See, so you don't get your contribution. These are all kinds of techniques that have been used. Management taking control of collective bargaining itself to roll back the magnitudes, to eliminate scope of negotiations of the previous decades. Workers' wages and benefits rose from 1947 to 1973, along with correlated with the rise in productivity. Workers get more productive every year in this country. And wages rose along with it. But what's happened since that time is with the attack on unions and the reversal, inversion, transformation, whatever you want to call it, collective bargaining, what we've seen is the rollback of those wages and benefits, the rollback. It's not coincidental that wages and benefits stop rising along with productivity. After the mid-1970s, strongly correlated with the attack on union membership and the attack on collective bargaining, and we will see the attack on union political activity, the third element here. Because, a lot of this, a lot of wages are determined by legislation and law, minimum wage laws, which politically have been allowed to atrophy. We're not adjusting minimum wages as frequently, and when we do, we make sure that it's not adjusted to make up for the loss. So minimum wage and the 10 million workers who are just above minimum wage, they're going backwards very fast. As I said, also the elimination of overtime pay by simply, exempting people from hourly pay, and then all the creation of part-time temp workers in the last several decades, where they're not part of the unions, you can't negotiate for them, and of course they get less wages and almost no benefits whatsoever. If you're outside the bargaining unit as a part-time and certainly a temp worker, or in independent contractors, you lay off people and in your support staffs, marketing, and so forth, and then you simply say that, okay, we'll hire you back on a contract basis, but we're not going to pay any benefits, and you've got no guarantee you're going to get any work, et cetera. So all these are trends, but they're not by accident. They're purposely introduced by corporate America and their political allies in legislatures and in Congress and so forth go along with it. The decline in bargaining, the decline in union membership, the decline in political influence and effectiveness are all interrelated. And they are all the consequence of this corporate offensive, which became more aggressive on all those fronts. The unionization, taking over collective bargaining, becoming the increasing political influential force in the government and the political system itself, meant the decline of unions as a political force and other groups in society as a political force. We have a corporatization of the government unlike ever before in this country, and corporations are unleashed by, you know, with Citizens United and Supreme Court decisions to do whatever they want now. Okay, so collective bargaining, pattern bargaining is gone. National bargaining is gone. Maintenance of benefits that followed it. Concession bargaining continues. Maintenance of benefits as a backup solution is about to go. So collective bargaining, both on the wage front and the benefits front, is questionable today, whether it produces much. And, of course, we haven't even talked about those dimensions where worker rights versus management rights have inverted as well. Okay, we will next week have some guests on here, and we'll talk about the militarization of police and the urban shield movement in this country. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.